Hello and welcome to episode 13 of the Talking Football Podcast. My name's Derek Clark, and each week I bring you an exclusive in-depth interview with some of the most colourful and interesting characters in the game. If you've missed any so far, you can listen to them on iTunes, Spotify, SoundCloud, Podbean, and also on my website, derekclarksport.co.uk. It's a bit of a bonus episode this week, as I had the absolute pleasure to chat with a top football writer who's just released his debut book, Frozen in Time, which takes a look at the wonderful randomness of the old European Cup Winners' Cup. As a big fan of the competition myself growing up, it was a real delight to take a closer look at the tournament with the author, Stephen Scragg. So sit back and enjoy this week's episode of the Talking Football Podcast. Hello everyone and welcome to the Talking Football Podcast, where I'm delighted to say we're joined on the line with the author of Frozen in Time, a new book detailing the famous Cup Winners' Cup. It's Stephen Scragg. Stephen, thanks very much for joining us.
No problem at all, Derek. It's an honour to be on.
Excellent stuff. Stephen, the European Cup Winners' Cup was an old favourite of mine. I was absolutely gutted when they got rid of it. I'd love them to bring it back. What gave you the inspiration to write a book about it?
Kind of happened half by accident, half tongue-in-cheek, I suppose. I'm still writing another book that I put on the back burner while I did this one. And I'm a senior writer for a website and a magazine called These Football Times, and we do our series of podcasts. And we did a set on the glory days of the European Cup, UEFA Cup and the Cup Winners' Cup. And the Cup Winners' Cup hit, you know, they all hit a card, but the Cup Winners' Cup, a colleague of mine called Will Sharp really enjoyed it as an Arsenal fan who remembered them winning in 94, you know, and he got in touch and said, oh, I really loved that podcast, and he said, put it on your to-do list, you should be writing a book about it. And, you know, we laughed it off, and then, but the more I thought about it, the more it made sense. The 20th anniversary of the ending of the tournament was fast approaching, and I was in talks with a publisher about the other book that I'm writing. And just as an aside, I said, oh, I've got another idea on the blackboard about a book about the Cup Winners' Cup. It's, you know, coming fast up to the 20th anniversary of it ending. And they were just like, immediately kind of like, yeah, we like this idea, let's go with it. So it was just a snowball effect, really. And then now here it is. It's out there in the shops. It's all been a bit of a domino effect, really.
Yeah, and imagine that it would be quite fun and quite enjoyable to write the book. Was it? Did you have fun doing so?
It was a lot of fun doing it. I mean, I'm a child of the 70s and 80s, so I grew up with that as part of that sports night and midweek sports special generation that would tend to be the games weren't live, you know, or very rarely live at that time. We might get the final or a big high profile game here and there, but you know, football tended to be, if not in person, then you'd listen to it on the radio, and you'd pick up games on your own local stations. For me, it was Radio City in Liverpool, and or you'd turn to the BBC, and the days before 5 Live, we were looking at Radio 2, and it tended to be kind of like goal updates and reports in the first half, and then you'd get a second half commentary. So you'd be gripped by these games on the radio where the commentators sound as if they're on the surface of the moon, down a crackling yoghurt pot and a piece of string, and you'd be captivated by them, and then you'd want to see the footage yourself later in the night. And as a school kid, being able to have a late night up on a Wednesday to be able to watch, you know, Dinamo Tbilisi take West Ham apart or anything like that was just joyfully accepted.
Yeah, the kids of today, of course, have grown up without this tournament being in their lives. Can you just sort of, for the younger listener, just to describe what sort of tournament it was and how good a tournament it was?
It was a great tournament. I mean, all three of the major European competitions, as was, had a distinct feel to them. They didn't feel the same as one another. They were like three siblings that had very different personalities. So for the European Cup, where you had to be your own domestic champion, there was almost, you would have this 42-game qualification period the previous season just to get into it. So there was this kind of like high plateau kind of feel to it, and the shine of the trophy itself in the flashbulbs go off, it just felt enormous, basically, and the size of the trophy as well. The UEFA Cup had a stronger field within it because you were drawing in three or four different teams from each nation. But the qualification criteria was much lower. You could finish as low as fifth and get into it. So that took a little bit of the gloss off it, despite the strength of the field. And then the Cup Winners' Cup, it was you had to be your domestic Cup winner to get into it. And the thing about domestic Cup winners is that they didn't always make sense. They didn't always follow a rhyme or reason. You didn't have to be a form side. You could just put in this string of five or six imperious games to lift your domestic cup competition, and then it gained your entry to this European tournament the following year. Hence, you only have to look at like the English side of things in the 70s and very early 1980s, where three second division sides in the space of about 8 years qualified for the tournament.
It threw up all sorts of random things year on year. I mean, not to mention Aberdeen beating Real Madrid in a final, of course, yes, in the 80s as well. So, I mean, it was a competition that could spring up all sorts of things.
It was. I mean, that's the thing. League consistency, and you know, you can have a domestic dominance of league titles. One or two particular teams might contest. The Bundesliga in the 1970s, where the title battered back and forth between Bayern Munich and Borussia Mönchengladbach. So they tended to be the German side you would see in the European Cup. So you had that usual suspects nature to the other tournaments, whereas the Cup Winners' Cup was much more random. You would get big teams in there, but it was almost like a random generator. So Ajax, for instance, only played in it. They had a 20-year absence from the tournament. You know, they played in 61, 62 and didn't reappear in it until 81, 82. You can count on one hand the amount of times that Real Madrid, Inter Milan, Liverpool all took part in the tournament. So this European royalty, there would always be someone there. There would always be a massive team or two in the mix of things. But you would also have kind of like, you know, these hypnotic sides, especially from behind the Iron Curtain. You know, the Eastern Bloc sides that were mysterious and very skilled and very, very fast. And you know, they would be bewitching to watch. And then you could throw in the Welsh teams as well, who gained entry via the Welsh Cup. So you had like Newport County, who were facing a relegation battle towards the bottom of the third division, the English third division in 1980-81, yet they reached the quarterfinals of the Cup Winners' Cup and gave Carl Zeiss Jena a harder match than they'd faced in the previous two rounds. And one of those was against AS Roma.
Yeah, you mentioned that club there. They played, obviously, Tbilisi in 81, and you touched on the behind the Iron Curtain. It's interesting to find there was less than 5,000 spectators at that final. It seems hard to believe that could be the case.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's absolutely stunning. In an era where just because a European final was taking place on your doorstep, if it was in your city, it didn't necessarily mean that people were going to get up off the armchairs and go out to watch it. Whereas now, you know, you fight for a ticket now for a major European final. You know, the amount of major European finals were played back then in half-empty stadiums, not even half-empty stadiums sometimes, is quite startling. But there's something almost eerie about, you know, a major game like that being played almost behind closed doors. And indeed, one game was played behind closed doors when West Ham faced Castilla, which was, again, another wonderful sense of the random to it, was that Castilla were Real Madrid's reserve side, because reserve sides in Spain, the big clubs played down the divisions, the barred from reaching a division that the mother club is in, but they can play down the divisions. And Castilla, they reached the 1980 Spanish Cup final, the Copa del Rey, to face their own mother side, Real Madrid, and were well beaten 6-0. But within that, Real Madrid were winning the title. So it gained Castilla entry to the Cup Winners' Cup the following season. So there were crowd disturbances when West Ham went to Madrid to face Castilla. And the punishment was eventually haggled down from being banned, or there was a concept of them playing the game at Roca Park at one point.
Yeah,
but then it was switched. They eventually agreed to say, well, you can play it at Upton Park, but it has to be behind closed doors. And there was almost like a five-a-side feel to it. It's like a local five-a-side match. If you watch the footage, the doof of the ball, and you know, it's just such a strange experience.
Yeah, of course, the UEFA are introducing another tournament coming up, the Conference League, which I've got to say, it doesn't sort of enthuse me. But I guess, would you like to see the Cup Winners' Cup come back?
I'd love to see it come back. I'd love it to go back to the way it was, but I think UEFA have sailed so far away from what it was that it's just never really going to happen. I would love, you know, if this third competition has to take place, then, you know, strip it back to what it was and give us a knockout tournament that we could all watch and enjoy. That sense of occasion and jeopardy was what made European football so special back then. Whereas now it's such a, football's a small world now, and everyone can watch every league. You know, it doesn't matter whether you're streaming football or you're watching it on a sports channel. There's nothing that you can't watch anymore. There's no surprises to be found out there. If you want to know about Albanian Premier League football, then, you know, you'll be able to stream a game on a betting site somewhere or wherever it is. But yeah, I don't see them kind of like giving us what we want, basically, UEFA anyway.
Yeah, I guess it's one of those competitions, and even back then with the Champions League, European Cup, as it were, and the UEFA Cup, it was there was a sort of, maybe not an innocence, but it was a different time, shall we say, of football back then in the 90s.
There was a simplicity, and it was a level playing field as well. You know, there was no seeding in the draws or anything like that, so, you know, you were just at the mercy of whoever was plucked out of the hat.
Yeah, you certainly were. In terms of the book, Stephen, what's the reaction been like so far to it?
Yeah, really positive. You know, a lot of people kind of like excited. I've had a few pictures from people receiving it through the mail and ordering it online. And yeah, I walked into Waterstones last week and there it was, which is a surreal experience to see a book with your own name there amongst the, because you're automatically drawn to the sports section, or I am anyway. And to see my own books out there was quite an experience. But yeah, the response is really positive, and I think people just like it's almost like they seem to enjoy being reminded of things that lay dormant at the back of the mind. You know, it's something that they've lived through and they remember themselves, and there just might be like odds and bits and pieces that they've forgotten that just lay in the dark recess of the mind or the light recess of the mind. And to be reminded of games and players, the response has been really positive.
Yeah, certainly. And you said you're writing some other books as well at the moment.
Yes, I have another book on the go at the minute about the 1986 World Cup, which I'm looking to get finished early next year. And yeah, there are a couple of other projects that I'm looking at that it's just in the research. In the research section at the moment.
Yeah, we look forward to them. If people maybe want to get a copy of Frozen in Time, how do they go about doing so?
Yeah, it's in the shops. So if you've a decent bookshop nearby, then you could probably walk into the bookshop and buy it there, or install it over the counter, and online in all the regular places: Amazon, Waterstones, WH Smith, and all reputable outlets.
Fantastic. And if people want to maybe get in touch with yourself or find your work online, Stephen, how do they go about doing so?
Yeah, you find me on Twitter. I'm at @scraggy_74, and I'm a senior writer for These Football Times. So if you just put my name into the search engine, you'll find a raft of things that I've written there.
Magic. Fantastic. Well, Stephen, thanks very much for joining us on the podcast today.
No problem. Thanks, Derek.
Well, that was episode 13 of the Talking Football podcast with football writer Stephen Scragg. I very much hope you enjoyed it. Thanks again for listening. Remember, you can catch any episode you've missed on iTunes, Spotify, SoundCloud, Podbean, and at derekclarksport.co.uk. We're also on Twitter @talking_football and Facebook as well. Join me again next week for another outstanding guest. Bye for now.